Welcome to Success Made to Last. I'm Tim Moore. This is the podcast that talks with people who strive for excellence. Brought to you by Blinkist, where you'll find thousands of nonfiction books condensed to 15 minutes so that you can test drive them or just browse them for the key ideas. That's Blinkist, B-L-I-N-K-I-S-T. Today we have on the show what we like to call a good one. Capital G, capital O, someone who fulfills the promise inherent in Lincoln's famous phrase, whatever you are, be a good one. Good ones are rare. Former Governor Mike Huckabee grew up in Hope, Arkansas, and became Lieutenant Governor in 1993 and Governor of the state in 96, serving through 2007. In 2005, Time Magazine, of all places, named Governor Huckabee one of the five best governors in the United States. He has had radio and TV shows more or less ever since, with breaks when he ran for president in 2008 and 2016. Finally, he has written 14 books, with his latest just published, The Three C's That Made America Great, Christianity, Capitalism, and the Constitution. Welcome, Governor, and thank you for your time.
It is a pleasure to be with you. Thanks for having me to chat a while today.
Well, it's my pleasure, believe me. In keeping with the spirit of our podcast, Success Made to Last, Governor, let me start out with asking you a question I ask almost everybody that's on our show, and that is, we like to find out about the paths our guests took to follow their goals and dreams. Would you talk a little bit about your early days and what dreams and hopes you had and how, if at all, they directed you to your path?
Well, I can truly say I've lived the American dream. You hear people talking about it, but I've experienced it. I know it's real. And let me explain. I grew up in a little bitty insignificant town called Hope, Arkansas, that no one had ever heard of until Bill Clinton ran for president. I grew up poor. I'm the first male in my entire family lineage to ever graduate high school, much less go to college, meaning no male upstream from me ever finished high school, ever. 10th grade was about as far as anyone ever had gone. Did not feel myself a victim. I didn't grow up feeling somehow in any way underprivileged. I considered myself blessed to live in America, and it was drilled into me early on. Never be jealous of someone else and what they have. You may not have the natural breaks that some of the other kids in the neighborhood or at school have, but if you work hard, treat people right, and get a good education, you can do anything you want to, because this is America. And that's how I was raised. So I was very fortunate to have parents who instilled, first of all, a sense of optimism in me, that I didn't have to stay where I was started. And the second thing, I was so fortunate to have people who encouraged me along the way. My first boss, early pastors, people who saw something in me and chose to encourage me and not tell me, hey, kid, you're no good. That was really key to a lot of things. And they encouraged me to do things like read biographies of people, which I started doing when I was in the second grade in school. And I found out that people who had done truly remarkable things often started out what we would call today disadvantaged, and yet they overcame the disadvantages by hard work and taking advantage of opportunities. So, you know, I set out to do something better than what I started out doing as a kid, which the only job I could get when I was 7, 8, 9 years old was catching chickens. And every night when you go out there, they take you out there at like 10 o'clock at night in a chicken house. You work all night long catching chickens for 2 or 3 pennies a chicken. And the whole time I would say, what do I have to do so I don't have to do this for the rest of my life? And I would always get the same answer, you know, work hard, get a good education, treat people right. And that's when I determined at a young age, by golly, I'm not going to catch chickens for the rest of my life. And this, to this day, you know, people say, you ever look back in your life and think what it could have been? I said, you bet I do. Could have been catching chickens. And thank God that's not what I'm doing for a living. So, you know, I've been blessed beyond measure. And, you know, I know where I started. I'm grateful for it. I'm glad I did start there. I'm glad I didn't have a lot of privileges and that the way was open because of my last name or because my father had influence. None of those things were true. You know, and I can look back with some sense of satisfaction that in this country, you can do whatever you really want to do, and there's no guarantees. There'll be some setbacks. Believe me, I've had plenty. But I live my life as a person who has enjoyed the benefits of liberty and the benefits of a free country where the government didn't tell me what job I had to take. The government didn't limit what level of education I could obtain. And the government didn't tell me where I had to live and what I had to do for a living. It wasn't like because my father was a firefighter, that's what I had to do. I had options. And therefore, today, you and I are talking about this country and all that it means. And gosh, I hope every kid grows up believing in America, because it is a great place, the greatest on earth.
Well, we share two things in common. My father was raised in the Dust Bowl in Northeast Texas, in Choctaw County, Oklahoma. You know where those places are. And I was the first in the family. My father's family came to the country in 1741. And I was, too, the first in the family to go to college. I had no idea that was a remarkable thing when growing up in the 60s, but I certainly know that now. When and why did you decide you would get into politics?
For me, it was somewhat of a lifelong thing. I mean, even as a teenager, I was very involved in student government. I loved politics and current events. I was one of those nerdy kids that read the newspaper every day from the time I was probably 7 years old and watched the news on television. I kept up with things. You know, I thought my career would basically be in broadcasting. And part of that is because my first good job was at age 14 when I got a job at the local radio station in Hope, Arkansas. And that put me in the epicenter of gathering information, knowing information. I was a sportscaster, a disc jockey. I read news, did production. When you work at a little small town radio station, you do everything that there is to do, including make coffee, pick out the trash and all sorts of great, very elaborate and wonderful things. So that was one of the ways that it kind of spurred me on. I thought, you know, I'll have a career in broadcasting and then maybe one day I'll run for office. And then along the way, I ended up believing I would go into Christian broadcasting. My detour, everybody thinks that I was a pastor by design, and that's really not true, but I spent almost 12 years as a pastor. This was after a career briefly in radio, television, and advertising. And that was the training ground that really kind of helped form my worldview in a way that nothing else would have. During that time, I led the creation of two community television channels that were owned and operated by the churches where I was a pastor. So, you know, I knew media. I knew what to do with that. And so led the church to create a television channel, which was pretty bold to do that in the early 1980s and mid-1980s. But through the process, I came to realize that so many of the people who were in politics were not people who understood what the real problems were. These were people who loved politics. They didn't necessarily love problem solving. And as a pastor, I saw the world at a level no one else gets to see. And, you know, a lot of people think pastors shouldn't be in politics. I have the opposite view. I know of no profession in which a person sees the full spectrum of life, the best and the worst, like a pastor does. He's there at the best moments of life, weddings, birth of children, celebrations of great events of life. And he's there at the worst. He's there when an elderly couple doesn't have any food in their home and he brings them over a sack of groceries. He's there holding the hand of a person as they slip away into eternity at the ICU room with the family surrounded by them. He's there when the child of a young, hopeful, optimistic couple is tragically killed in a car wreck. He's there for every bit of that. There is no social pathology that the pastor can't put a name and a face to because he's dealt with it up close and personal. And I came to realize that why I thought that maybe going into the pastorate would take me completely away from politics, it ended up, I think, preparing me for it and giving me a perspective of humanity that nothing else would have. And ultimately, I decided, you know, this is what I need to do. And I did it. And hasn't always been successful. I lost my first race. I lost my last one, but I won a whole bunch in between and was able to enact some things that really made a difference in people's lives.
In your book, God, Gun, Grits, and Gravy, which I recommend highly, you talk about the two Americans, one on the coasts, which you call Bubbleville, and the other, which you call Bubbaville. Talk about these two places and why you named them such.
Well, I think the great divide in this country is cultural. I would also go further to say that it's really spiritual, but there is a cultural division between the people who live in what I call the bubbles of America. And those bubbles are basically New York, Washington, Hollywood, and I would add Silicon Valley. And those are the bubbles in which when people live in those environments, they have a different worldview about what's important and what isn't than people who live out in the flyover country. The reason I named that particular book, God, Guns, Grits, and Gravy, is when people would ask me, did I live in New York? Because they knew my television show at Fox was based there. And I said, oh, heavens, no, I've never lived there. I said, they would never let me duck hunt in Central Park. So, no, I'm not going to live in New York. And can you imagine somebody taking a shotgun out to Jackie Onassis Pond and busting ducks out there in the middle of the day? I don't think that would go over real well in New York City. So I said, you know, I don't live in New York and I don't live in Washington like a lot of people probably think I do. I say I live in what some people call the flyover country. I live in middle America, or as I like to call it, I live in the land of God, guns, grits, and gravy, a place where people are comfortable talking about God, that they don't consider themselves weird, and other people, you know, don't run for cover if someone brings God up into the conversation because they don't think it's strange, odd, or eccentric. And I said guns are things that people own and people grow up with them. And it's not just for hunting, but for self-protection. And nobody is scared to death that their neighbor has guns. You know, it's not considered abnormal. You know, I say grits is staple food. We know how to cook it and how to make it wonderful. And I said, and to people in flyover country, especially down south, gravy is a beverage. So if you add all that up, I live in a place very different than the bubbles of Washington, New York, Hollywood, and Silicon Valley. And I don't live in Bubbleville. I live in Bubbaville, where there are good old boys that like to drive their trucks, go fishing, go hunting. But I said, I'll tell you something. If you get stuck out on a dark country road somewhere, who had you rather have stop and help you out? Somebody who knows how to change your tire in his pickup truck, or some dude in a nice Beamer who wouldn't even know how to get the jack out of the trunk, much less change the tire? I said, give me some good old boys any day, because not only can they help, they'll actually stop and try to help.
I spent most of my life in Bubbleville up in the Northeast, and my kids and I now live here in Texas. And my kids continue to marvel at the fact that, you know, there's all kinds of people here. There's people who agree with us. There's people who disagree with us. It's not like back home. Everybody believed the same thing. And you had to keep your mouth shut if you didn't believe what they believed. And in the preface to your latest edition of the book, you note that liberals and other Bubbleville commentators lambasted you for suggesting such a place as Bubbleville exists. It reminded me of Pauline Kael's famous admission in the New Yorker in 68. She said, who are these people who voted for Nixon? I don't know a single person who voted for him. Let's let that sink in for a moment. Governor, how does such provincialism continue to exist in the so-called most sophisticated parts of this country?
You know, it's very similar to what was going on in 1968, and there are people living in the bubbles. I look at some of their tweets. I listen to them when they are pontificating on television. They find it absolutely astonishing that anybody, for example, would ever vote for Donald Trump. They just can't believe it. They just cannot believe that anyone in his or her right mind would do such a thing. And it's because they live in a very limited world. The irony is they think that they're all about tolerance and diversity. And their idea of diversity is how big a piece of avocado toast they have for breakfast. They really have no idea that there are people who are completely unlike them and that they're really pretty nice people. And they assume that they're ignorant. They assume that people outside the bubbles are unsophisticated, that they lack any literary knowledge or capacity, and that they're miserable people. When in fact, we're very satisfied with life. We love living. We're joyful. We have a great sense of humor. We don't take things as seriously as people living in the bubble sometimes. And as a result, we're just totally misunderstood by those who have never broken bread with us, invited us to sit down for a cup of coffee and actually listen, not to what we believe. They may know that. They don't know why. And they may not have a clue as to what makes us tick and how we came to be who we are and why we are. It's one of the great things that I lament today is it used to be, even just a few years ago, I could go on a show with Stephen Colbert, Jon Stewart, and, you know, they didn't agree with anything I stood for, but they listened to me. We had an open conversation, and at times it would be even like, yeah, okay, I can kind of get that. Today, people are angry. They're mean. They're not interested in a conversation. They don't want to know what you think. They don't care. They just want you to go away. They want you to be canceled. They want your view to be destroyed. They want your job to be annihilated. And frankly, they would be totally happy to have you shouted out of the public square, thrown out of restaurants, completely taken out of the job market, have your voice eliminated, so that the only voice they could hear would be their very tolerant voice. While they preach diversity, there is no diversity whatsoever in that mindset. None.
Let's talk about your new book, The Three C's That Made America Great: Christianity, Capitalism, and the Constitution. Why did you write it? I mean, you've written 14, this being the 14th or 15th, I've lost count. Why did you write it? Talk about its themes and message, although the title and subtitle is very clear.
Well, I feel like that there is a lack of information, especially among younger people, but even among baby boomers, as to how this country came to be. What were its underpinnings? It's a foundation upon which we were built. And my co-author, Steve Fiesel, and I put together what we believe are the three C's that did make America great and unique. And those three C's, Christianity, which really is the Judeo-Christian worldview. It doesn't mean that the government imposes a Judeo-Christian religion on people. It does not mean that people are required to go to a particular church or, for that matter, any church. It just says that you cannot escape the fact that our country was clearly founded on the principles that were derived from the Old and the New Testaments. And a lot of that has to do, the most specific thing I would point to is that the Bible describes people as individuals who are personally responsible and accountable to God. The Bible does not describe us in collectivist terms, but individual terms. I have a personal responsibility to God. I'm personally accountable for the life I live, the sins that I commit, and the forgiveness that I give. What made America a great country is that spiritual underpinning. The other two things, capitalism, which is the idea of economic liberty, that I can choose to do the things that I want to do. I can take risk. And sometimes those risks may pay off with great rewards. And if so, I get to enjoy the fruit of that labor. I get to own land. Most people don't understand that there aren't that many places on earth where a single individual can own his or her own property, actually own the land on which they live and work. This is huge. And it was especially huge at the formation of our country when people only owned land if they had relationship to the crown and the king approved it. And then the final thing is our Constitution, which is a magnificent document, brilliant in its design and in its execution. And one of the genius things about the Constitution is its capacity to be changed by a thorough, thoughtful, but rather tedious process. In other words, it was not given so that it could be changed by passion and by anger and hostility. If it were changed, it would have to be changed very thoughtfully and very meticulously through a very challenging circumstance that involved the people's representatives. But you put all that together and you have a very unique country, one that has an amazing history. And one thing we did in the book is we document everything. We made sure that we didn't just say, yeah, the early Ivy League schools were founded as Christian colleges to train ministers. Now, we give you chapter, verse, we give you names, places, dates, the documents that back that up. And I'll give you an example. Harvard University, which started out as Harvard College, was named after John Harvard, who was a young minister, died at the age of 31. Harvard was essentially created to train pastors. And one of the things most people don't know is that in the earliest days of Harvard, throughout most of its early history, Harvard required its students to spend 2 periods a day in prayer and Bible study and the memorization of scripture. And the statue of John Harvard, which sits in Harvard Yard today, can you imagine, do you think most students at Harvard have any idea that they are a part of a college that was originally created to train Christian ministers? And that if they were true to their heritage, they'd have to spend a couple of times a day praying and reading the Bible.
And Yale was founded as an alternative religious organization or alternative religious college to Harvard. So what is that? Two of the three oldest colleges in America?
The same history is true of Princeton and Yale and William and Mary and basically all the Ivy League schools, Columbia. The only exception really is Cornell, was not really founded so much for a religious underpinning, but the others all were. And it's just one of those things that I doubt many Americans have any clue that that's the case. And I would urge them, read my book, look at the sources. If you can find that we're not true to history on that, let me know. But you won't be able to do it because that is the honest to goodness history of these schools and our country.
Why have we lost? Why have we lost this knowledge? Where did it go?
Over a period of time, people have almost been ashamed and afraid to admit who we are. That became more true since the 1940s, when there was a decided effort in the country to move us away from more of a Judeo-Christian country and to be more secular. And then it became really pronounced in the 1960s when the Supreme Court, believing that it could make legislative decisions, not just judicial, determined that things like prayer, the reading of the Bible in a school was unconstitutional. I mean, it was a ridiculous ruling in light of our actual history. But that set in motion a chain of events that secularized our culture, not just our schools, but our culture increasingly. And the courts became more and more a partner to that mindset. And a lot of local communities, frankly, just caved in because they didn't want to have to engage in the battle. And in many cases, they lost when they did. And the result is that now we have a society in which it's like it was in the time of Judges in the Old Testament, where everyone did what was right in his own eyes. So today, if I talk to young people on a college campus, when they tell me what they believe, here's what I hear. Well, let me tell you what I think. Let me tell you what I feel. Let me tell you what I believe. To think, feel, and believe is wonderful. But what are you basing that on? Just your own sentimental feelings? Maybe you had too much pepperoni pizza. Maybe that's what you're feeling. But this notion that we act on our what we think, feel, and believe rather than act upon fact and act upon objective truth is really disturbing. And when I hear someone say, well, let me tell you what my truth is, that's the dumbest thing I ever hear somebody say. There is no such thing as my truth. Truth is objectively true or objectively false. There's no subjectivity to what really is true. Gravity either exists or it doesn't. I can get up on top of the roof of my house and I can say, you know, I just don't feel gravity is a threat to me. I don't think gravity works. And, you know, I think I'm going to jump off this roof and fly to my neighbor's roof. Well, I can feel that. I can think that. I can believe that. But when I jump off my roof, I'm not going to land on my neighbor's roof. I'm going to be turned into a busted melon on the sidewalk down below, because what I think, feel, and believe does not overcome the reality of truth, which is objective.
As Daniel Patrick Moynihan said, you can have your own opinions, but you can't have your own facts.
That's exactly right.
You, and he said that now, what? Wow, my goodness gracious, it's 50 years ago. You have a wonderful newsletter, and I recommend it to everybody listening. And recently in it, you said something that I've heard before and forgotten. Dennis Prager once mentioned to you that he can tell if a person is either a Republican or a Democrat within a minute into the call. And the reason for that is that the Republicans are happy and the Democrats are angry. By the way, this is borne out by the field of psychology, which is called happiness research, and particularly most notably, some research conducted at UCLA about 15 years ago that showed that, in fact, conservatives are more happy than liberals. Why is this, in your view at least?
I think because we look at life not from a temporal standpoint. We don't see our lives as beginning at birth and ending at death, and that's all there is. We see our lives as part of a greater sense of eternity. Look, I'm not trying to over-spiritualize conservatism or republicanism, but generally we do embrace that notion that there is more to life than how much money I have and what job I have, and that the ultimate sense of justice is going to be brought by a much higher power than me or any political figure. It's going to be brought by God. But that gives me a release. It gives me something to strive for and work for. But I don't feel personally that I have to achieve it all. I have a sense of humor. And I have a sense of humor because I believe I was created in the image of God. And I think he has a sense of humor. I look around and I say, you bet he had. Look at the people that he made. He's got a sense of humor, all right. I think that there's also this sense of which when I'm free to love people who are different than me, and I do, I don't hate anybody. How can I? God made them. And if God made them and God made me, it's impossible for me just to have raw hate for someone, because then I would be saying, God, you made a real mistake when you made that guy. That guy you should not have made. And because he turned out like he did, you got to strike him with lightning. Well, I don't look at life that way. I just don't. I read some of the reactions to things I tweet most of the time, tongue in cheek, and people are genuinely angry and they're hateful. And, you know, one person sent an email to my television show and said, I hope you and your daughter both get COVID and die. And I thought, wow, what causes a person who has never met either one of us, who has no idea who we are, how would anyone come to the conclusion that it would be okay to wish upon another person that they just die? I don't understand that. It's beyond my capacity to relate to it.
Yeah, it's mind-numbing. We just passed through a little past weekend, people laughing at cops being shot and hoping they would die in L.A. And it's, you know, that there aren't words to express the you know, we've lost words to describe the depravity of people who think like that. It's, I mean, I don't know, shameful. I mean, we need to invent new words. It's extraordinary. And you know, I think that's a segue to the modern times or the present. And I wonder, and I'm interested in your view, have we reached the point of no return, as the subtitle of Michael Anton's new book suggests? Or are you an optimist? And for either view, why?
I'm resigned to the fact that we may be on our last leg if people don't wake up. But I'm also an optimist. I do believe that there resides in this country a deep-seated understanding that we shouldn't be celebrating the murder of police officers. And we shouldn't even be celebrating the defunding of police officers, that we understand that there may be some bad cops from time to time, but we also have 99% of guys who just sacrifice their own safety for the rest of us. And we ought to be grateful to them. And we ought to recognize that when people commit crime, they make themselves vulnerable to some things that the rest of us may not be vulnerable to. Cops make mistakes, and sometimes they may take down a good guy. But more often than not, they take down a bad guy. Maybe they take him down with almost too much force that could even result in his or her death. But that's the rarity. Cops, you know, are not on a daily basis getting up, putting on their badge, strapping the gun on and saying, boy, I sure hope I get to go kill somebody today. I mean, that is crazy. And if you've ever been around police officers, you know that's just not true. People don't live for that. They pray they never have to pull their weapon. They're not psychopaths. But the people that would go out on the street, walk up to a police car, and indiscriminately and in cold blood try to murder two cops in L.A. or anywhere else, that is psychopathic. That is beyond sickness.
When I was a kid, I'm 1 year younger than you, but I won't mention the age of either of us. But when I was a kid, people said, today is considered mainstream. I mean, they would have been locked up instantly for insanity. How did such an entity take over the public square? And maybe I should lead the question a little bit with my own view, which is, I think we've allowed the inane to take over our education system, K-20, but you answer as you see fit.
Well, I'm always of the opinion that deep in the heart of America, there are people who just love this country. And honestly, they don't want a lot from their government. They just want to be left alone. They just want to raise their kids, live on their street in safety. They might vote. Maybe they don't. They should, but maybe they don't. They just want to go to work, get their paycheck, buy the stuff they want. They want to be able to work hard, take a vacation where they want to go, do the things that give them pleasure, and then for the rest of the time, just be left the heck alone. And I do believe that that's the side of America that a lot of people will never understand, because they're living in a world where they want to tell everybody how to live, what to do, what you have to believe. We see it, you know, today in some rather stern ways. And look, I don't have a problem wearing a mask. I wear one when I go out places publicly these days, parks, which is required. And sometimes just because, you know, I'm a person in that high risk group who's had double pneumonia. I'm 65 years old. So I'm going to be careful. But, you know, when I see the mask police go out and shout at somebody because, you know, they're standing outside and they're not wearing a mask, I'm thinking, really? Have we all now become the mask police? That seems a little extreme to me. It defies that sense of personal liberty and freedom and respect for other people and a respect for the fact they may not view life just like I do.
You know, do you watch RFD TV at all, Governor?
RTV?
RSD TV.
You know, occasionally I do. And, you know, it kind of reflects that part of America that I've been talking about.
Yeah. Yeah, there's a couple of shows. So, you know, I don't know why I brought it up other than the fact that you tickled a couple of neurons, but there's a couple of shows on there that... you know, I never saw until I moved down here because RFD TV wasn't available in Northern New Jersey. And there's a couple of shows on that to just make you so bittersweet, I guess, and mournful of the loss of, you know, the kind of fellowship that you described that we have in Bubbaville. One in particular is called This Life I Live by Laurie Peake, and I recommend it highly to everybody out there. And maybe that comment is apropos of nothing, but I watched that show and I think to myself, wow, you know, where's all that gone? But in any case, I digress. Tell us about your thoughts on the coming election. What's at stake in your view?
Well, I think there's more at stake than ever has been. We say that every 4 years. This is the most important election of our lifetime. Mm-hmm. And usually it's not that that's untrue. It is true. But in this case, it's more true than ever. And I'll give you an example. First of all, we're in a real crossroads as to whether our future economic system will lean more toward capitalism or socialism. And those are two very distinct and very opposite worldviews about how people should have the things they have. Should they have them because everybody goes out and maybe works, maybe doesn't, but when it's all said and done, everybody gets the same thing, and the government is the one who redistributes the wealth of the collective body of people? Or do we believe that as individuals, we go out and we work hard, we take some risks, we pick some things we'd like to do, and some of them we know will pay better, and with that, we purchase things that give us pleasure. We may give away more money because that gives us pleasure. But we make that decision. The government doesn't. And if we don't work hard, we don't get as much. But if we work really hard, we have a chance to get a whole lot more. And that drives us and it motivates us. The second thing that's at stake is our judicial system. If we're going to elect someone who will put on activist judges who believe that the courts should legislate when our elected legislators don't have the guts to do it, we're going to be in a very different place than what we were designed to be, because our courts were never designed to be a strong body. They were designed to be the weakest of the three branches, equal, but weaker because they didn't have the power of the purse, as does the legislative, or the power of the sword, as does the executive. They really only have the power of influence and suggestion. They cannot enforce it, and they cannot change it. And that worries me when you see people who believe that you appoint judges and justices to the Supreme Court who can change the culture into what they think it ought to be rather than what the people have willed it to be through their elected representatives. I think also we're looking at a very different view toward our foreign policy. Are we going to appease enemies like Iran and China? Are we going to just bow down to them, roll over for them? We've lost millions of jobs in this country because we allowed the Chinese to cheat. And why did we do it? Because the power of donations to political figures from companies and corporations that were getting rich off our trade deals with China, Mexico, and other countries changed our body politics. And the people making those decisions, largely in Washington, the lobbyists, the legislators, and the donor class, they didn't care about the guy out in Youngstown, Ohio, who was losing his job in a manufacturing plant. They didn't care at all because they were making millions of dollars selling us out. And this is where I think President Trump has been spot on in saying, we're not going to sell out Americans and American companies and American jobs. And let me be very blunt. The reason that he is so hated in the Beltway of D.C. is not because he came and he failed to do what he promised. They hate him because he came and he did exactly what he promised he would do. He would change the way that Washington works. And so when you see these people, some of whom claim to be Republican, they're harsh, never Trumpers. What I see are people whose pretty little world got all messed up because he showed up and said, we're not going to do business like we've been doing it. And business like we used to do it meant that Democrat or Republican, no difference. They always bowed to the donor class. When the donor class shook the change in their pocket, the politicians jumped and did exactly what they were told to do. Donald Trump has not come doing that, and it has been transformational in the political process.
Yes, yeah, they hate him because he told them explicitly that they were wrong over and over again. I have one last question for you, Governor. And there's a lot of talk out there that if Trump wins, the West Coast might secede. Not that that's a negative. And that Texas might secede if the opposite occurs. How likely do you think those scenarios are, or is that just frenetic talk?
I think it's talk at this point. I can't see that it would actually happen. If it would, I think it'd be more likely California would decide to be its own country, not Texas. But I don't see things. I think that there's a fear that if the president wins re-election, there'll be some people who even more than they were in 2016, who never accepted the results of the election. They never said they could deal with it. I mean, they said for 4 years, he's not my president. I'm thinking, yeah, he is. You might not like him, but he's your president. When Barack Obama got elected twice, he wasn't the guy I voted for. But I never said in 8 years, he's not my president. He's not really the president. I never said that because I lived with the fact that people voted him for him and he became president. I didn't have to agree with his policies. But even in that, I didn't hate him and I didn't wish harm upon him. I wanted him to be a good president. And I said it publicly because him being a good president was good for the country. There were a lot of things he did that I think hurt our country. But I never personally hated him or wished him harm.
What's the way back to unity in your view? How do we bring ourselves back together? I mean, it almost seems like we are rending apart and doing it consciously.
Well, I think we have to see people who have a real heart for our country as it was intended to be. They have to go vote. You know, this is amazing to me that there are still people today who said, my vote won't matter. And they honestly mm-hmm. believe that their vote is unimportant. And I'm thinking, you know, it only takes about one person per precinct across the country to think that, and we get a very different government. It was pointed out in 1960 in the very close race between John F. Kennedy and Richard Nixon that had there been one vote per precinct across America cast differently, Nixon would have won. Frankly, I'm not sure that I'm disappointed that JFK won. I'm a Republican, but I had great admiration for JFK. I still do. I was a little kid during that period of time, and I loved what he wanted to do with the space program. JFK, by the way, today would probably be a Republican. Mm-hmm. He was pro-life. Mm-hmm. He was anti-communist. He was for economic conservatism and lower taxes. He wanted a strong national defense. He would not recognize the Democratic Party today as it is. But the point being that it would not have taken but another vote per precinct to have shifted that election. And there are many times when just a little bit of movement one way or the other can change the course of history.
After all, it was only 80,000 votes in three states that gave Trump the election last time. That's not a lot of votes, is it? Out of what, 123 million?
Yeah, you know, I say to people, particularly my fellow evangelicals, there are roughly 80 million evangelicals, maybe 81 million in the country. Half of them aren't registered to vote. And of the half that are, about half of them vote in the presidential election. If all of those registered evangelical voters voted, it's game over. And if all of them who are eligible to vote would register and vote, it's a landslide. If they voted for Trump, and most of them would because they are committed to a pro-life position. They are committed to a strong Israel and an Israel-U.S. alliance. And they're also strongly for law and order. And they believe that we ought to be governed by laws equally. Just think about that. I mean, and I don't understand why people can say, well, I'm sitting in the pew on Sunday, but I'm not going to go vote on Tuesday because I think politics is dirty. And I'm thinking, it's dirty because people like you look the other way and you don't participate in this incredible experiment of government that we get to rule as people. So get out of the pew and go vote, for heaven's sakes. Vote your values. And if your values are different than mine, okay, I get that. Not everybody who even shares my evangelical faith will vote Republican, and I understand that. But I would they would just vote their convictions and vote their values and truly be sincere about that.
Well, in closing, maybe one of the ways that we can find our way back to comedy is that people can read your book and let me your new book, and I will repeat the title and subtitle again: The Three C's That Made America Great: Christianity, Capitalism, and the Constitution. Governor, thank you very much. I know you're a busy man, and you do a lot of media, and I appreciate your time today. And very much good luck with your book, and thank you for all the work that you've done, not only as a politician, but as a broadcaster for America.
Well, I appreciate it. It's been a pleasure to visit with you. I hope we can do it again. Thank you.
Well, thank you. Thank you very much. And for those of you out in podcast land, we hope that you've enjoyed this podcast. Remember to go to successmadetolast.com to register for our newsletter, filled with fun information about our future guests and great stuff in general. And go to your podcast distributor, iTunes, Spreaker, etc. And rate our show, please. Till next time, go out there and live the best version of you.
So let me tell you a little bit about Blinkist. Blinkist is the most useful app on my phone. And it's really hard to find time to sit down and read and learn more. And when you don't have free time, you can't read or work on personal development. There's this incredible app that solves this problem, and I highly recommend it. It's called Blinkist. Blinkist is really unique. It works on my iPhone, And it could work on your tablet or web browser as well. Blinkist takes the best key takeaways, the need-to-know information from thousands of nonfiction books, and condenses them into just 15 minutes that you can read or listen to. Successful people, like business leaders, are well known for reading lots of books, and Blinkist is made for busy people like you who want to get the main points of a book quickly so you can start using that information right away. And with its audio feature, Blinkist makes it easy to finish a book during your commute or lunch break or while you exercise. There's 12 million plus people using Blinkist right now, and it's got a growing library of self-help, business, health, history books. And you can go to Blinkist.com to see some of the latest titles. I like Blinkist because listening to some of the most popular books that I just haven't found time to get to, including Alexander Hamilton by Ron Chernow and Super Thinking by Gabe Weinberg. Two great books. So right now, for a limited time, Blinkist has a special offer just for our audience. You can go to Blinkist.com/success and try it free for 7 days and save 25% off your new subscription. That's Blinkist, BLINKIST.com/success to start your free 7-day trial today. Give it a shot. You will love microburst learning from Blinkist.